Welcome again. Is there anyone here for the first time at one of my sessions? All right, then I'll give a little explanation then. I am Elizabeth McCann. Ellie works too. I am a pastor in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and I am, through our Global Mission Program unit, called to serve as a pastor in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and the Holy Land. It's my first call as a pastor, so it wasn't necessarily anything I was looking for. It just kind of came and happened. I had connections to Global Mission because I had done my internship through them in Oslo, Norway, and so there were lots of different things in life that just kind of ended up converging, and I ended up in Jerusalem. So I've been there for just shy of a year right now. And I serve as communications assistant for the church. It's the only indigenous Lutheran church in the Middle East. Six congregations with about 2,000 members. We also have four K-12 schools with about 2,000 students. Our students are 50-50 male-female and 50-50 Christian-Muslim. And then we also have four educational programs, a home for boys, another kindergarten in Jerusalem, and a senior center in the old city of Jerusalem. And you'll get to meet the people where I actually bought these from. They're my people. And that's one of our young adults in Global Mission on the left with Awesome, who is the scarf guy in Bethlehem. We also have an environmental education center. So it is a church with deep roots and a very broad mission, and they see themselves as a very service and academia-based. I decided to do this session today on Palestinian art, tradition, culture, and then I said remembering, renewing, recycling. The occupied Palestinian territories, as I've talked in previous days, are not an easy place to live or to be right now, and not an easy place necessarily to find education. There is also the concept and question of normalization, of growing up in an occupied territory, growing up being told that maybe you don't belong there. And that is part of the reason that Palestinians claiming their culture, claiming their heritage. I don't know why you're searching. Apparently something just came undone. Go to sleep. Let's see. Are you going to find it again? There we go. That's good. But that Palestinian art, tradition, and culture has become and is becoming even more extremely important to the telling of their stories, to part of their narrative, and remembering and claiming their roots. Thank you. Yeah. That helps. That helps a lot. And so it is very wide-ranging. What we're seeing pictures of right now is from the Arts and Crafts Fair at one of our schools in Beit Sahur, which is where some of these come from. And in Beit Sahur, they learn, part of their art classes is learning traditional Palestinian culture and art and handicrafts, but also taking that and letting it become an outlet and a transformation to something new. I'm in Awesome Store right now with some of the cushion covers that are here, right here, when I was trying to decide between all of these as to which ones to get. And so we see it as very much a part of our role as educators to not only teach the basics of reading and writing and arithmetic or whatever you want to call it these days, but also to encourage the arts and to help these students to find where they are and where they fit. In other ways, it has become extremely important in empowering women in Jerusalem and in other parts of the West Bank. I'm sure fair trade is something that you have all heard about, if not participated in the years. That's another one of our young adults in global missions, Sarah, and we're in a Bethlehem store right there. And these are two of the women that help run this store that collects handicrafts from women in the area and helps them to sell them for a fair return on their labor. I just came out of the Bible study this morning, in which we talked about just and generous and fair and whatever. And I think in the States we're very used to getting things for a very low price. And when we actually look at the amount of work that probably had to go into that, we're probably looking at pennies that people actually get paid for a lot of this stuff that we buy. So some of the concept between fair trade is taking out some of those middle people and trying to get connections. Oh, and now it's really, you're gonna, well then, come here, one second. We're just gonna change this and we're gonna tell it, the display, not to go to sleep. Come here, you can do it. I find that my computer needs a little bit of display sleep. Never.
Right.
Play. It won't be great for energy, but it's 1 hour, and then I'll change it back. And especially with the problem of emigration in the West Bank, and of it being easier sometimes to be outside of the situation, one of the things that has happened. I heard one story from the crowd yesterday. I think Heidi told it about an 80-year-old couple immigrating. But a lot of the times, it's more the younger generations that emigrate. And it's the older generations in the midst of the society that has been very communal and very much one in which you take care of your elders and you live as a very extended family unit connections that... emigration has also changed society and put a lot of strains on that, because what happens when your children or your grandchildren move away? What happens if your husband or your sons are put in jail or if they are forced to leave? How do you support yourself? And so those are a couple reasons of how stuff has come. Part of this resurgence or importance of Palestinian handicrafts, art, tradition, and culture also comes from storytelling and the need for storytelling and the need to find hope in the midst of the situation. I'll lift these up as an example. After the Second Intifada, the Second Uprising in 2000, in which tanks entered and were all the way into Bethlehem Square, the square by the Church of the Nativity, and glass windows all over were burst out. The church in Bethlehem, Christmas Lutheran Church, gathered up the shards of glass, said, how can we make something new out of this? How can we recycle it? How can we find hope in the situation? And so the stained glass angels and crosses, and it has grown to lots more stuff, came out of that moment in which there seemed almost to be no hope. And these are sent out. I brought them because I think they're beautiful. I brought them because I think the story they tell is important. I brought them because it was really fun to get to put, you know, so much money into the local economy when I can't really do that necessarily on my own. But a lot of the biggest reason and the hope that I have for these things is that the people who they go home with, when people walk into their homes or your homes, and people say, oh, wow, where did you get that? And when you're carrying a purse or you pull something out of your purse or a pillow on your couch or something, people say, where did that come from? But there is an opening, there is an invitation there to share the story and to say, hey, I haven't necessarily been to Jerusalem or to the West Bank or whatever, but I've had a chance at Holden Village to go to some conversations and to be in conversation and to learn a little bit more. And this is what I learned, and I want to tell you about where this piece came from. And getting the face-to-face connections and the story connection. So that's maybe a little bit of background. Part of this is I also just want to tell you about the people that these come from. Okay, while we're on these photos, right now we are in Awesome's store, which is an awesome store. that's how I remember his name. But that's Awesome. It's actually spelled A-S-E-M when he transliterates it into English. And Awesome's store is just probably about 150 yards away from the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. It's just off Manger Square. Those are young adults in global mission again, and now we're somewhere else. But we'll come back to it. But Awesome's main store is actually right next door. And his is the last fabric store left in Bethlehem. And the last place where local people actually can come to buy their fabric locally. But in order to support that, he has his shop next door. And he is locally known as the Scarf Guy. Because you can go to Awesome's store. And I just have a few here. There's a black one that I forgot up top as well. There are, you know, the normal, where you can get just about everywhere, like the pashminas, the little ones. And these don't necessarily tell a story so much, but they were bright and they were colorful. And that's why I got them. And then, you know, the bigger pashminas, the ones that are super soft and warm. This one's purple and black and different on both sides. They come from around the area. They aren't necessarily the biggest storytellers, but Austin said, that's okay, you can take those. He said, but make sure you take some of the keffiyehs, too. The keffiyeh is the traditional scarf, very Palestinian. Most often you'll see it in white with red, or black on black, or white on white. And that's traditionally what they have been, and they have been used to keep the very hot sun off of your head in the summer and to keep you warm at night. And I'll see if I can do this quickly, okay, and not have it fall off my head. You can have the rope coverings, but you can also just do it comme ça. How did I do that? This way. And roll it in. And I did this very messily, and I don't have anything. But you have something covering your head to keep the hot sun off of you, and it's very easy to do and very easy to keep. So this would be traditional Palestinian. But the keffiyehs have also become something else. They have become something in which they also see their future, and something in which they have allowed it to grow and become something that there are now all of these fashion colors of keffiyehs, and I have one up top of the hill that I bought to be a part of this, and I was like, I just can't, I love it too much. and as Austin says, you never know if you're going to get the same color again. So I was like, well, if I come back later, I can get this color too, right? And he's like, you really never know, because he never knows. But these ones, the more fashion ones, most often you see them just worn like that. And they still have the pattern of the keffiyeh, but they have branched out into, you know, what can we do with this? How can we make this more accessible? How can we see the future through this as well? And so their tradition and their cultures and stuff, but they're also allowing them to really grow and to expand and to become something new. I think as they know that their lives and their country and stuff needs to grow and become something new. So those are the scarves from Austin's place. But
Ellen, just
yeah,
tangential. You mentioned that Awesome has the last fabric store in Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. Why is he the last or the only fabric store in Bethlehem?
A lot of it is the same reason that businesses such as this fail in the States. The fact that it's much cheaper to bring in super cheap pre-made stuff from China and from other places in the world in which we are okay as people with those people being paid almost nothing.
Do they do the patterns like Palestinians? I mean, are the Chinese actually doing pattern type cloth?
I mean, there's pashminas that are made for cents on the dollar in other places in the world, and a lot of these things, these ones would actually probably either come from Palestine or from Syria, the ones that are here. But it's the same. It's not something that is only in the United States or only in Canada or only in northern countries. This, I think, is also part. Mitch just walked in here.
Yes.
Well, I was just saying, they were just asking. I was saying that I bought these scarves from Awesome, who owns the last fabric store in Bethlehem, and they were asking, you know, why is it that this is the only one? And I was saying, well, because just like everywhere else in the world, it's so much cheaper to bring in stuff pre-made and prefabricated. And I remember Renee coming back from her first time in Haiti and saying that had also had a major impact on
Haitian also.
Economics and stuff. Yes. And that it's easier and cheaper.
Do you know if he sells any of this stuff outside of Israel? Like places like, do you have 10,000 villages here?
We do have 10,000 villages here. Awesome stuff, no, but there are a lot of people who come to his scarf shop who are wholesalers who will buy like 100 from him, and they will take them back and sell them for who knows how much. But yeah, so he doesn't directly work with that. But some of the other things that I'll show you today are either available online at fair trade stores, and some I think are available through 10,000 villages. So it is getting these things connected. As the last fabric store in town, Awesome also makes up the blank pillowcases. And then he works with women in Bethlehem and will bring them the fabric and will bring them the embroidery and will bring it to their homes. And they will stitch it there in their homes, and he will come back and pick it up and give them more fabric. Yes. I'll get to those in a sec. That's what our kids do. And as they grow up, all the way starting from kindergarten. Here, I'll pass a couple of these around and start at different ends. You can see the traditional Palestinian stitching embroidery is cross-stitch. It is very intricate. Here, actually, I'll pass this piece around. Sorry, this piece was already bought. But especially this piece here, this is the finest piece of stitching that I brought with me. And you can tell how fine the stitching is. Like, well, when you see it, you'll see that it's tiny. But also, if you look at it on the back, it's pretty much just as beautiful on the back. And so there's a lot of love and a lot of care and many, many hours put into a lot of these pieces. So Awesome also does that and works with women and stuff around. Maybe I'll go to our school stuff because we've just seen some of those. As I said, our schools also do... Oh, am I still wearing the same one as in that photo? I might be. Our schools also start, I'd say probably a vast majority of our students go on to university, but like I said in previous days, unless you're willing to leave the country, sometimes it's hard to use your university degree. There aren't jobs, and a lot of the jobs that are available are in the traditional handicrafts. It is also an economy that very much booms and busts with what is happening and how that affects tourism in the area, but also just the importance of learning about culture and roots and stuff. And so our Beit Sahur school, students work on crafts every year throughout the year, and then to support the extracurricular activities that these art things are, they have an arts and crafts sale at the end of the year, and so I got to go to that this year, and they had so much fun showing us everything. Here we go. We are in the arts and crafts fair right now. You can see these right there at the bottom. And these are the students. Everyone from kindergarten on gets to display their stuff at the arts and crafts fair and gets to be a part of it. And These ones are rather funny. I was like, what did you do to those Barbies? I don't know if I took a picture of them, but the littlest kindergartners, and these are some copper etchings and squishings. They're really beautiful. They had one that was the Lord's Prayer in Arabic, and you can see a Palestinian woman dancing dabka there on the left. And then this is some of the, you know, where does their artwork go in the future, and how does this change at the bottom? You can see a painting there of the wall and tanks. And the Dove of Peace crucified on the cross. These kids think about these things a lot, and they don't paint tanks out of nowhere. There's the dove trying to get over the wall, the crying eye, and the Palestinian flag wrapped in razor wire. These are things done from their memory and done from their lives. And so part of this is also just a chance to just be able to make something beautiful to do that. And so they do little pottery, and they get, and I brought one example of, this is from Majdi's shop, and I'll tell you Majdi's story in a couple of minutes, but this would be the Palestinian pottery that you'll find in the shops, but what they start with, and this isn't necessarily incredibly traditional. And then these would also, these are examples from our kids that I bought these at the Arts and Crafts Fair as well, of some of the stitching that our youth do, that our youth at our schools do, and the fishes, and love this one, it's a head. A dove descending and a heart and these flames and this light. And they get a lot of freedom in deciding, you know, how they want to take this traditional thing and move it into the future. I also have some Itna stuff with me. And Itna is a small town in the southern part of the West Bank. And it's a place in which there is a women's cooperative, and it does some of the most amazing stitching that I have seen. And this is another way of taking something traditional and making it into something new. The stitching on this bag is the same stitching that would appear on the top part of the bodice of the traditional Palestinian dress. This here would be open, and that would be the neck, and the neck would be there, and then there would be little panels of stitching that continue to go down, but most of the rest of the dress would be black. And it's not necessarily the traditional dress that is now worn every day, especially by the younger generations, and so this is a way of carrying that history and that tradition with them as they go on their way in a different way, and a way of reimagining it. Also, I'm sure had something to do with tourists who loved the dresses, but were like, well, we'd never wear that. I gave a bag to my best friend Renee when I first went about 4 years ago now, and she wore it everywhere, and so many places she'd go, and someone would say, where's your bag from? Where can I get one? And I think Renee is kind of my, like, epitome of a person who's going to tell the story of where something comes from. Thanks. And so she told, and there was one time that she was actually at a talk about Palestine and Israel, and this young woman came up to her and said, where did your bag come from? And Renee said, well, it came from the Haitian refugee camp in Bethlehem. And the woman said, I knew that. I'm Palestinian. And she was actually from Bethlehem. So this is some of, like, the beginning of the traditional to take forward, and Idna's Women's Cooperative, they also sell through Sundula, SUNDULA.org, which is how a lot of Palestinian things are sold abroad, fair trade, through their website. They can also pack up, both Sundula and Christmas Lutheran Church can pack up big, like, huge, like, $400 worth of stuff boxes for, like, Christmas sales or stuff like that. So that's still more traditional. And then it gets more into fashion and more into reimagining for the future. This is a bag from a women's cooperative that actually works out of Jerusalem, I believe. I think, or is it Nablus? But this is a Christmas present for my sister-in-law. but still has that very defined stitching. Yep, they've also, you know, allowed it to be played with, and it's not something that necessarily you would look at first and say is Palestinian, but it still carries that story. Majdi's story. I want to tell you Majdi's story. My skirts come from Majdi's shop, all the skirts that I've been wearing this week. So does this pottery. I also already sent a present. I bought a little girl's tea set, a Palestinian pottery tea set there that went back as a Christmas present for a kiddo at Wartburg Seminary. Majdi knows just about all the NGOs and groups that come through. Who knows? It's likely that Heidi has probably met Majdi at some point in time. And Majdi owns the Bedouin shop, is what his shop is called in Bethlehem. And it has moved now, but it used to be just off of the square of Bethlehem, major square in Bethlehem. And during the... Oh, come on. Didn't go to sleep, but it did do that. During the first Intifada, I believe. I'm not quite sure if it was the first or the second, but I think it was the first. My colleague in Jerusalem, who is now the pastor of the English-speaking higher engagement, also assistant to the bishop, Dr. Fred Strickert, who taught at Wartburg College for many, many years, just about every year took groups. And he had a group there once, and they had a free day in which they were doing some shopping in Bethlehem. And in the morning, they were going about, and there was this shopkeeper that said, "Oh, come into my shop and have some tea." And as Fred tells the story, he was brusque, if not downright rude, in saying, "I don't have time for you. We need to get going somewhere." Later in the day, a skirmish broke out, and Fred and Gloria, his wife, only had some of their students with them. And there was tear gas fired, which you can actually die from. It is that strong and that potent. And there were live ammunition rounds being fired, and Fred did not know where three of his students were. He was like, oh my gosh, where are my students? But obviously you can't run out into the middle of it. And so as soon as it was safe, he ran out and tried to find them. And as he was running by, the shopkeeper said, "Stop, come with me." And it was the same shopkeeper, and he's like, "No, I don't have time for you." And he started to run off, and the shopkeeper says, "Abuna Fred, Father Fred, and come with me." And Fred again is like, "How do you know my name? I don't have time for you." He goes to go off, and the shopkeeper says once more, "Abuna Fred, you are looking for your students." He says, "Yes, your students are safe." "Well, how do you know that?" "Your students are in my shop. Please come." And when the firing had started, he had run out into the street because he had seen them, and he had said, "Come, you need to come in." One of the three young women had actually fainted from the tear gas, and he ran back and he picked her up and carried her into his shop and was able to revive her and to get her to wake up again. And he kept them safe in the back of his shop and served them tea, and they shared stories together. And as Fred tells the story of Majdi, and I believe it was in the Lutheran magazine after that, I didn't realize that the Majdi I was talking to a couple months ago was the same Majdi. I heard this story. But Majdi and Fred and Gloria have been very good friends since that point in time. And Majdi also takes care of everyone else who comes. And when I was in his shop, I was there with another ELCA pastor's daughter from Montana who lives in Bethlehem. And he said, you're a friend of Katie's, and you're a friend of mine, and completely and wholeheartedly means it. But then we're also finding out, and one of the young volunteers from the Mennonite Central Committee had been living in a questionable place, and he found out, and they were looking for a new place for her, but he said, you can't stay there. You can't. Come in, live with my family until you find a place to live. And she did. But when Majdi found out that I knew Fred and Gloria, he was like, oh, you know Fred and Gloria! And he brought out this original edition of the first time this story that Fred wrote about their encounter was printed and showed it to me and just spoke about how much it meant to him, when I also know how very much it meant to Fred and Gloria. So these people, and they're very real and very generous and very caring. They don't do this for the sake. I mean, obviously, we're talking this morning about just or fair versus generous or whatever. And oftentimes people can like look and come in and just get bombarded by all the people saying, come in, have some tea, come to my shop. And yes, I as a blonde young woman, I'm most often thought to be just plain a tourist. And especially it's really hilarious on my walk into work, there are certain people that I pass in the little city every day, and they know who I am, and they know I'm a pastor, and they know I work there. But if I wear my Canada t-shirt from the 2010 Vancouver Winter Games, they completely and utterly forget that they know me and see me 2 times a day. And I get, Canada, Canada, come here, come into my shop. And I just stop and I look at them and I say, hi. And they're like, oh, hi. You can still come in. But the generous offer of tea or of something cold to drink is not simply about trying to sell you something. That is who they are as a people. And it was Arab hospitality that was actually the reason that I knew that at some point in time I would work with these people. I didn't realize it at the time, but when I went, I came back and I wrote a newsletter article for my home congregation after my first trip, after I did a January term in Israel and Palestine. And I had written in there just about the hospitality of these people and how they had blown me away. And I had said in there, I think at some point in time, I think I'm going to get to know these people more. And I really never thought that would be first call, but I was going back and writing a newsletter article after I had accepted this call, and suddenly I pulled up my old one, and I was like, whoa, how did that happen? One last story. Which is the story of this nativity and the story of these. It's fine. That's why I love these nativities. This nativity, and then I brought also from this place little doves, and then this is also up there because these are presents for seminary classmates who either just had or are having babies. They're little caterpillars. But, here, pass it out. These things are made of felted wool from local sheep, and they come from a Larsh community in Bethlehem. I don't know how many people here know or have encountered Larsh communities. Yep. And Henry Nouwen was a big part of a Larsh community, if you know his writing. from my understanding, and feel free, because I don't know a ton, but they most often, do, or always, either most often or always, work with people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And inclusion and community. And it is a large community in Bethlehem from which these pieces come. They're all pieces of felted wool, and they are all pieces that there are workers who come every day who are people with disabilities who not only know how to make these, but also teach people who are coming in, to people who come and visit them. They say, do you have time to sit down? Can we teach you? And I love the pieces for a lot of reasons. I think they're really beautiful. I love the fact that Bet Nativity comes in 3 or 4 different sizes. There's one that's about this big. And if anyone was here last week and met little baby Eleonora, who is the only baby born at Wartburg Seminary in our senior year, and the child of very, very dear friends of mine, Ben and Renee and John's. I brought her a little nativity for Christmas because she's one, or she's now 19 months. At that point in time, she was just over one. And it didn't make a difference if she squished it. So it was just felted wool, and it would come back. I am also really, really pleased and love to have a large community in the midst of our community as well, and the things that they make, and the stories that they tell. Just one last thing that I didn't talk about that also comes from here, for our Bates Ahura School, which is something that is very, very normal, or I mean, not normal, but prolific. In the Bethlehem area are olive wood Christmas tree ornaments. And I look at these, and I have been to, it's in the same like arts and crafts facility that we have at Bates Ahura. And I look at these like 13, 14 year olds with like they're like bandsaws. So I'm like, wah! But they do all of the work themselves. And from a stamp to cutting to finishing and to putting it all together. And they're so proud to know that like their stuff is sold in their school store and that they are a part of enabling this program to exist, this arts and crafts program. And they're some of the favorite things that I love to have hanging on trees. I think I've told the stories of all the different people. So now, questions?
What about crafts from the men?
Crafts from the men, a lot of the olive wood and mother of pearl stuff is often the men, and it's often the men who work in the stores, in the more touristy stores that sell them.
So the women make it, the men sell it?
Not all of this stuff, but some of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Olive wood stuff, and then stuff that comes from there, most of the stitching. The pottery and the stuff that we do at our schools, both young men and young women participate in that. But a lot of this stuff, women's cooperatives have been very important because there aren't necessarily as many places for women to work outside of the home, and so this is empowering them.
I appreciate very much you bringing the story here. I wonder where else are you going to be before you return?
I'm actually nowhere else before I return this time. Wilbo Mission brings their missionaries home every 2 years, and so this was not the year. So this is my vacation time, and the flight is also mine this time. I'm great, very grateful to Holden, who has helped out a bit with the flight, and they've helped out with the Haiti week. But because of that, my last 2 weeks before this, I had to be in Geneva to help with the Lutheran World Federation Council meetings. So I'm actually gone from being on the ground there for a whole month. So on Saturday, I fly back. I'll take two red eyes in a row. A red eye from Seattle to Atlanta. I'll spend all day at the Atlanta airport. I'll take a red eye from Atlanta to Tel Aviv, and the next day I'll go to work. But next summer, every second year, you have 2 full months of home leave. So next summer, I'll have 2 months, and the congregations who are my missionary sponsors in the ELCA, I'll have a chance to go and talk to all of them. If there are global events or something happening, we try and make that work to have some of us represented there. There are also some places that I'll just be going because that's where family is, so hopefully I'll be doing some talks and some conversations in Alberta, Canada, which is where I'm from and where I grew up in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada. I was back in January as well, and it was really fun because I got to preach 3 times. I preached at my best friend Renee's congregation, which was very meaningful. As I shared the same video that I shared on Tuesday night, I actually made Tuesday night's video for Renee's congregation because her congregation is a mission congregation that meets at the Youth Correctional Facility for North Dakota. And so if there were any kids, any youth that could get what it felt like, I thought that it would be those ones. I also had a chance to preach at a couple of different congregations in the Dubuque area, and I did confirmation for my previous home congregation in Wisconsin. So they keep us pretty busy when we're not in country. But yeah, so next summer I'll get to have a couple of months to tell the story. For now, it's just been really good to have a couple of weeks out.
Yeah. Is your friend Renee the one who is here? So you.
So I was here helping out with Haiti Focus Week last week, which is really the reason that I ended up as teaching faculty here. And Holden just said, hey, you have, you know, this major connection to this other place that the ELCA has a major connection and justice connection to, which is willing to stay and teach for the second week.
I think the two have really gone together.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Ellie, I have a question for you. So in Palestine, women don't show their legs because even though they wear long skirt, and then I saw there was something under the
oh yes, mm-hmm. I am a part of the reason I have my like skirts with me today, these couple of weeks, is because part of me has gotten used to not showing my knees.
Okay.
In Palestinian culture. Normally shoulders are covered and knees are covered. In Palestinian Christian families, especially at weddings, there really aren't those restrictions at all. But the video that I showed of the dancers, our schools are 50-50 Christian and Muslim. And our schools don't want to differentiate or show differentiation from one to the other, and so our dancers, there obviously have to be slits in their dresses and the ability for their legs to do what they need to be able to do, but they wear leggings underneath. So they have leggings underneath. Yeah.
I was also interested in the intersection of your Christian and Muslim students.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how that are the families of both involved together, or how does all this go?
Yeah. Christianity and Islam have lived side by side in that part of the world for the last 1,400 years. And they have very much so. Christians are seen as very much an integral part of Palestinian society and culture. They are not apart from it, but a part of it. And so in that, especially in these communities, Bethlehem, Beit Sohor, Beit Jala, are communities that are more historically, have a larger Christian presence. As I said in an earlier talk, our congregation in Ramallah, which is just north of Jerusalem, and our congregation in Amman, Jordan, are congregations that were born out of Lutheran refugee families who asked to have congregations and So our older congregations are the ones of Bethlehem, Beit Sofer, Beit Jawa, and Jerusalem. Students, it is open enrollment as to who chooses to send their students there, and there are a lot of Muslim families who choose very purposely to send their students to our Lutheran schools because of the peace education, because of the respect for all religions, that is an integral piece of our schools, and that there is no differentiation made between these students. For religion classes, you go to the religion class that is yours. So Muslim students go to Muslim religious class, Christian students go to Christian religious class. But one thing that is particular to our schools is that once a month, each of those grades have their religion classes together, and really get a chance to learn about one another's religions and to learn by talking together about them.
So I lived in Senegal where 90% of the population is Muslim,
mm-hmm.
and in one family in Senegal there is Christian and Muslim together. Does that happen in Palestine also?
That is an area in which they are working on.
Okay.
proselytization of someone who is in a different religion or a different family is not smiled upon in any way, shape, or form. So most of the time, no. But one of the conversations that they are in the midst of having right now in dialogues is that there also, though, there needs to be that openness I go back to what one of my professors in seminary, Winston Prasad, who is Indo-Guyanese. He's from Guyana. And he always told us that dialogue is not dialogue unless you are willing and open to the fact that you might come out changed. And that we can't have interreligious dialogue without being open to the fact that we might be changed.
Mm-hmm.
And that also means that there has to be an openness in the communities that that overt proselytization is not something that any of the religions do, but that if someone chooses a different religion, that is okay. And so that is something that they're conversing on right now and talking, and that is very much part of the dialogue right now.
Intermarriage between religions, Arabs, Christians.
Doesn't really happen.
Doesn't happen.
there isn't dating like we would know. It's just not culturally. It's not necessarily something that's forbidden, but it's just not cultural. It's just not something that's a part of their culture or what they do. And children grow up very much knowing. I mean, religion is very much a part of their being and who they are. And I'd say most of the time, children grow up knowing, well, I'm Christian. I'm going to marry someone who's Christian. That's where we get into a lot of the family reunification problems with such a small Christian population.
If I recall, when I was in Israel many, many years ago, there were separate civil marriage rules for Orthodox Christians and Muslims and Jews. In the Palestinian civil society, how's that work? Is it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I can answer it to some point because there's a certain point that I know to, and then there's a point in which I don't. Marriage and family stuff is not something that is dictated or controlled by the state. There are family and marriage courts or laws and rules in the different denominations and different I'm losing the word, the proper word for faiths. Yeah, different faiths, but also within faiths as well. For a while now, the ELCJHL, I think they've been together with the Anglican family court type of thing. That's the easiest translation I can come up with. They're in the process of setting up their own family and marriage system. And so that's a lot of discussion right now. The women of the ELCJHL this year, and in the last year, they were focusing on issues of health, especially women's health. This year, they are focusing on issues of marriage, and the conversation at the post-Easter gathering was on the issue of marriage, age of marriage for young women, the dangers and challenges of very young marriages, and also we had a social worker and a lawyer, both female and both Palestinian, come in and talk to these women also, and a lot of these women are mothers of younger women who are married, about what happens in issues of abuse and talking about abuse, physical, mental, verbal. And so these are issues that are also a part of thinking about family court. At times they're difficult because divorce is really not an accepted part of Palestinian culture. And there are actually various instances, both for males and females, in which I do strongly disagree. Cases of abuse there are a couple of fathers that I know, because divorce doesn't exist, sometimes families will just live apart. But then there's also no legal ramifications and no legal ways sometimes for these fathers to be able to see their children. It's one of those issues that, for me, ignoring it is not the answer. but it takes a while to come, and also it is definitely my job to accompany. And I think in Kirsten's talk last night, she was talking about how people can't impose and force people to do things in one way, and that's the same thing with mission and with accompaniment. I think we've learned over the history of mission that coming in and saying this is how you do it and that's wrong, that does not work. But these are questions that the ELCJHL is asking themselves, and I trust we'll continue to ask and walk in dialogue with.
About women, would you classify them being oppressed in this society, or are they treated fairly overall in this scale?
I don't know if really in any society you can say overall across the board. I don't think you can even say that in North American society. There are checks and balances, but we're still not at equal pay in North America for men and women in the same jobs in a lot of places in a lot of instances. Gender equality is, I can't speak for Palestinian culture necessarily on the whole, simply because I don't necessarily know it incredibly well. I know in our schools and in our churches that gender equality is very rooted and equally rooted in our peace and justice education. That gender equality is very much a part of that, and lifting up the young women in our schools and encouraging them in further education and in uplifting them in their skills. Same for women on council, and now women in ordained ministry. Don't have one yet, but it is on the books and it is open. I think I had a moment of like crazy when I struggle with our fellow Lutheran sisters and brothers here in North America, where I know that some of my family, who is Missouri Synod, that I would not be welcome to be a pastor there. So all I can say is it is a major part of our own schools and our own education. Across the board, it probably really depends on where you are and how rural or how city and various other different family aspects, because the society is so very family-based. We are most definitely out of time. It's lunch. These things will be going over to the bookstore. If you see anything that you absolutely love and want, the bookstore gave me the prices, so you can just like walk it over to the bookstore and pay for it. But thanks for letting me share some stories of this.